And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, ecology, stories from the land, faith, recipes, interconnectedness, relationships, and life itself. We are your hosts, Helge Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
We have a great show lined up today as we are discussing the role of faith in ecology and the responsibility of faith-based institutions to communicate and practice environmental stewardship. It's a hot topic, and we're very excited about our guests today. Religiously green, faith in ecological leadership, all that and more on this week's An Organic Conversation.
Yeah, you know, so many people consider their relationship with the land to be a spiritual one. And what excites me about this show today is that we're actually going to look at, you know, how the Bible and ecological leadership are connected. But first, here are the green headlines with Jen Lloyd.
Thank you, Mark. More on solar power in a country with an energy legacy tainted by the Chernobyl disaster and a dependence on Russian gas pipelines. The Ukraine will soon become a leader in Europe's clean energy movement. The largest solar power plant on the European continent, totaling at 80 megawatts, is under construction in the Ukraine. In addition, the country aims to build 2,000 megawatts of clean energy capacity and produce 30% of the Ukraine's energy from renewable resources by 2015. The first ever National Heirloom Exposition will be held in Santa Rosa, California. From the 13th to the 15th of September, the three-day event will showcase hundreds of varieties of heirloom vegetables, fruits, and animals, and will feature a long list of world-renowned speakers headlined by Dr. Vandana Shiva, Alice Waters, and our very own Helge Hellberg. The first ever National Heirloom Exposition is sponsored in part by Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company. For more information, check out the heirloomexpo.com. And this summer, a group of food activists from all across the United States commemorates the Freedom Rides of the Civil Rights Era with a journey exposing food injustices in communities across America. The Food and Freedom Riders are traveling throughout the country to expose and uplift stories from farmers, food chain workers, Indian reservations, community garden supporters, and communities already working to combat food and health issues related to obesity. The writers will also teach youth about food production, federal food policy, and carry their message for real food. Real food, as defined by the Food and Freedom Writers, is food that is, quote, that's good for people who eat it, good for the environment, and good for those who are producing it, the farmers and farm workers. And these are this week's green headlines. Back to you, Helge.
Thanks, Jen.
Wow, Helge, world renowned. World renowned? What are you going to be speaking about Vandana
Shiva
at the Heirloom Expo?
I don't know yet exactly. It always comes out to relationships and diversity. I mean, it's an heirloom festival, so we talked about the beauty of diversity and how we can embrace the differences that make us up, both in vegetables as well as in people, and celebrate that. That's really the richness of life for me. And within that, the relationship to one another. So however I start my talk, it usually ends up being about relationships and diversity.
It sounds like you're going to be doing a Helge's Organic Moment there at the
that's right, expanded
at the expo.
For 20 minutes.
Yeah, for
yes, if you're interested in Helge's Organic Moment for 24 minutes, come to Santa Rosa in 2 weeks. Yes, very fun. That will be great. Looking forward to that. And you are listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll take a quick break, but stay tuned for our first interview with Jim Deming, the Minister for Environmental Justice for the United Church of Christ, only here on An Organic Conversation as we're looking at the relationship between faith and environmental stewardship. More on that when we come back right after the break.
You remember me when the west wind moves upon the field. Body. You'll forget the sun in his jealous sky as we walk in fields of gold. So she took her love for to gaze a while upon the fields of Bali. In his arms she fell. As her hair came down among the fields of gold, will you stay with me? Will you be my love among the fields of Bali? We'll forget the
and we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today's show is about faith and the environment and the role of faith-based institutions in environmental leadership. We were prompted to look into this topic by stumbling upon a news release by the Catholic Church all the way back from 2008 that we just found a few weeks ago that went fairly unannounced in 2008 when it came out, when the Catholic Church announced seven new deadly sins. The original deadly sins, as we all know, are pride, envy, gluttony, lust, anger, greed, and sloth. And they are now joined by a new set of seven social sins that the Catholic Church deemed inappropriate and as a deadly sin, including polluting the environment, contributing to widening the divide between the rich and the poor, excessive wealth, and creating poverty. So we wanted to give this hour to exploring the relationship between church and the environment, the responsibilities and leadership that is being provided by faith-based organizations, and look at what could still be done, the opportunities at hand. Our first guest is Jim Deming, the Minister for Environmental Justice for the United Church of Christ, who really has taken on this topic and question. And he's joining us today from Cleveland, Ohio. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's such a pleasure. Mark and I heard you speak at the Ecological Farming Conference a good half year ago in California. And, you know, sometimes we get inspired by hearing a talk that goes beyond what is usually often being talked about, goes beyond the common conversation that is being had at that time. Your talk blew both of us out of the water because you were taking on a topic that has been lingering in the organic movement for many years, as far as I'm concerned, where we were looking for a strong partner, making the organic movement part of the environmental movement and including something like the church, for example, into it. How would it be if the church preached every Sunday that organic, eating organic foods in our households is a faith-based act? And you really addressed that. So,
well, thank you. Appreciate that.
When did you find that passion? What prompted you to connect the environment with your work as a minister?
I guess I'm old enough to remember the first environmental movement when the Cuyahoga River burned and people began to get more involved and become conscious of the connection between the way we live and all the things that we use and misuse, as a matter of fact. So I've been at this for a while, and I worked in Ohio for Rails to Trails and helped communities build greenways, and I've been very close to the land for a long time, and I've always said that that the trees are God's cathedral, so that I've been very connected to it in a very spiritual way.
And it seems like a natural connection who do see nature as part of their place to worship. And yet you're really bringing it into the institution as well. Are there any historical roots that you draw upon? Like in your talk, you were addressing literally going through the Bible and saying you are interpreting the word of Jesus Christ or the word of the Bible as, encouraging us to take care of the environment.
Well, sure. I think if we look clearly at this and closely, the work of Ellen Davis at Duke University, she wrote a book called Scripture, Culture, and Agriculture, and it's about agrarian reading of the Bible, and she goes back and talks about the Hebrew people. Of course, Jesus was a Jew, and, you know, agriculture was in his DNA. All the metaphors and ideas that he had were certainly agrarian references when he talked about the wine, turning the water into wine, the fruit of the Spirit, all kinds of things like that. Those are the metaphors that he used because the Hebrew people were an agrarian people, and when they came out of Egypt in the Exodus, they moved from a very fertile land into a very dry land, and they had to take care of it. And part of the covenant that they had with Yahweh was that they not only inherited that land, that was their understanding, but they also were to take care of the land. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look way back even to the first scriptures that are about creation, the stories of creation, there in the Adam and Eve story about the Garden of Eden, it says that God took the human and set him in the Garden of Eden to work and serve it, to preserve and observe it. So these kinds of ideas are certainly from a historical context.
Yeah, which is exactly what we're talking about every week on this show, that it's really the observation that makes a good farmer, right? You have to observe your site-specific conditions, in this case, the site-specific conditions of the Garden of Eden. Very specific, of course.
Sure, that's right. You know, it's funny. Somebody asked me recently about people of faith. He says, I'm not a member of people of faith, but a community of faith, but, you know, and I said to him, you know, the community of faith is not just about people who go to church. The community of faith is about people who have hope and vision and work towards that.
So, and reverence, yes.
Yes, and the community of faith is much larger, and people who go to church are not necessarily members of the community of faith sometimes, too. And I believe that very strongly, that farmers are people of faith because they believe that something's going to grow when they plant it, that it's going to come up, and they care for it. And there is a vision of what it would, the pleasure it would bring to people from what they grow, too.
Yeah, there's actually, I believe I remember reading a quote sometime, to have faith in the seed. I think it was Thoreau, or about having faith in
Beautiful.
A seed. That's the
yes.
one thing that's good, that you are going to get to grow.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so Jim, is there a scripture in both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament that make this connection? I know you just gave us a little example of that, but do you find it in both books?
Well, I do, and you know, one of the primary scriptures we use in the United Church of Christ is the one from Micah 6, where it talks about what is your task, O mortal, and that is to love God, to do justice, and to practice kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. And there is a sense of the way we live our lives, the lifestyle we live, has something to do with our own faith. And people aren't always making that connection, but within the scriptures, there are a lot of instructions about how we approach God's creation with some degree of humility. In the first scripture, of course, the stories of creation in Genesis, we try to make the distinction between, is creation an entitlement or is it a gift? And the way you respond to a gift is with gratitude and appreciation, and that requires a whole different response from a scripture than something that says, is that all there is, which is an entitlement response.
Mm-hmm. We're listening to Jim Deming, the Minister for Environmental Justice for the United Church of Christ, who has taken on the topic of church and the environment, faith-based organization, their role and responsibility to be also stewards of the land and to teach and preach about environmental leadership and stewardship. Joining us today at An Organic Conversation, I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And Jim, you are really, this is your topic, right? You have worked in, over the last years, on developing a grassroots environmental justice movement within faith-based organization and the United Church of Christ, where you trying to you know, the curriculum in a way, or a certain pattern of teaching with that it would include all 5,000 congregations. That seems like an amazing goal. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, it is kind of a huge task. I mean, that's one of the things we're trying to do. I'm certainly not alone in this. There are many people who are leading this charge, too. One of the most active people is Jim Antal, who's a conference minister in Massachusetts, and he is even asking his ministers and his 1,200 or so congregations that are in that area to preach one sermon a month on environmental stewardship. And he says, if we don't do this, within a number of years, we'll be preaching every Sunday on this, that we are at a critical point right now. And so there are people around the country in our congregations, a lot of them in New England and the Midwest and the West Coast, who really are more and more aware of this all the time and understand that the church has a special call to do this, to take care of God's creation. This is a fairly new movement, though. It hasn't,
yes.
has blossomed since 2000 in many ways, since there was an awareness of this more and more, since climate change and global warming and all those kinds of issues have come up, people have become more aware of it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Jim, you're talking about the congregation, the 1,200 in Massachusetts, and of course the 5,000 and people in your own congregations. But I haven't heard about this, and that's why we're so intrigued to do the show. But you're saying that since 2000, more and more congregations are agreeing to have this conversation.
Well, they are, and it's not just the United Church of Christ, and it's not just the progressive denominations. Many folks from the evangelical tradition are doing the same thing. And I have on my website, ucc.org, and it's not an ad for it, but I'm saying I have a list of things there under environmental ministries where people can find from all different faith perspectives the people who are working on it from their faith perspective, including Buddhist, Presbyterian, Catholic, you name it. There are people working on this who are very concerned about it. So this is not a solo act by any means, and I'm joining a lot of partners in moving towards this.
And Jim, we have you on because we do want to promote your work, because we are in awe and very much inspired. So please say that website again. Please promote it.
Well, it's ucc.org, and just go to Environmental Ministries, the part there, and then go to Resources, and you'll find some things. I've tried to make it paper-free so that people can actually contact that and see where they can go. And they can feel free to contact me as well if people are interested in that. My email is on that website, and we hope to do more.
So, just to clarify, Mark just mentioned it's 5,000 people in your congregation. It's actually 5,000 congregations within
right,
the United Church of Christ.
Around 5,000 to 5,500 congregations.
So how many people does that equal?
I think we're about 1.5 million people right now, something like that.
So how is that embraced? How is that message received by the congregations and by the people that attend church? Is that a natural connection? It seems for so many years, you said it's a pretty new movement and awareness that is now really being embraced by churches all over. Why this late? Why now? Finally now, that's wonderful. And how is the feedback?
I think it's a great question, and I think it varies by the region of the country. From the South, where I am, people don't necessarily interpret their faith community as a place where you deal with issues like this, but it's becoming more and more the norm. In New England, where we have a lot more progressive congregations who have been dealing with this for many years, it's an easier shift at that point to really become involved. Our congregations are involved with all kinds of social justice issues, so this is a natural thing for us to move into. And people do it with great vigor, as a matter of fact, and with a lot of worry. And I'm working with a group called Transitions Towns, and they are really doing some great things, too. And we're working on a model called Transition Congregations.
And we want to dive into that right after
sure.
the break. We'll stay tuned, Jim. This is great. We're talking with Jim Deming, Minister for Environmental Justice for the United Church of Christ, today looking at the role and responsibilities of faith-based organization in the realm of environmental stewardship. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll be right back after a quick break. Stay tuned.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sisters, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sisters, let's go down, down in the river to pray.
My name is Earl Herrick, and I am the owner of Earl's Organic Produce, a San Francisco Bay Area distributor fully committed to organic produce. From the time one could find organic fruits and vegetables only in natural food stores to now, when schools and fine restaurants feature organic, we have been forging relationships with growers for over 20 years. If you want to offer the finest organic produce to your employees or customers, find us at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Frey Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frey never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frey organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frey Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at freywine.com. That's FreyWine.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Syngevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Syngevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Do you feel run down, stressed, overweight, or overloaded? Urban Remedy is a delicious 100% organic juice cleansing program designed to jumpstart your body's natural healing and cleansing abilities. This delicious juice feast, created by leading acupuncturist Nika Pasquale, is rich in vital nutrients, minerals, and enzymes, providing you with all the nutritional nourishment you need to thrive. Delivered directly to your doorstep. Urban Remedy, a convenient way to boost your energy and balance your body. Place your order today at UrbanRemedy.com. That's UrbanRemedy.com.
Over 25 years ago, my husband and I started a business around our passion for ginger. We called it the Ginger People. Today, you can find our products at natural food stores nationwide. We love ginger. It's what we do. And the more we learned about the amazing properties of ginger, the more we realized that everyone benefits from eating ginger every day. My name is Abby Leeson, and I am with the Ginger People. To learn more about our products, the goodness of ginger, and how it can improve your health, visit gingerpeople.com. That's gingerpeople.com.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Helberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today's show is dedicated to exploring the relationship between church and the environment, the responsibilities and leadership that is being provided by faith-based organizations. We're speaking with Jim Deming, the Minister for Environmental Justice for the United Church of Christ, joining us today all the way from Cleveland, Ohio. Jim, we spoke before the break about all the initiatives that are going on and beyond preaching environmental leadership and the our responsibility for the environment and environmental health. It goes much, much further. You said it really shifted in 2010, and we now see churches every other month that put solar panels on their roofs throughout every congregation and any faith-based organization throughout the United States and even beyond. What are some other movements that you are observing, and why 2010? What shifted in the recent years? Why now?
I think... It's hard. In the first environmental movement, there was a grassroots movement, and a lot of folks got involved and were very concerned, and we passed a lot of laws. And those tended to take care of things for a while. We cleaned up the air and the water, and there was a complacency about that. And we didn't really understand what was happening with global warming and climate change. With some of the new information that's come out through the films that have been shown after 2000 and all that, we began to understand this is a whole different problem, that this is not just about making some adjustments, that we're going to have to make some transformations in the way we see the Earth and use the Earth's resources, and they need to be sustainable. And so that's, I think, when people of faith became more and more involved, because it is transformational what needs to happen. This is not just about changing some light bulbs. This is about involving everybody in a new way of thinking about God's total creation and how we're going to stay here and how the planet may live after we're gone, some of us.
And so what are other movements that you see that are being embraced? There's energy, there's, the church has always been known for creating social justice or working on social projects within communities, but really the environment and energy are one of the two big ones that are now being addressed.
Yeah, this affects everybody, and I think that's why we feel like we have to have a voice in this. It affects public policy, affects this as well, is that this is not just sort of a spiritual issue where we can be isolated from other people. This involves moral choices that we make in our culture because food is a moral choice, where it's grown, how it's grown, the pesticides that are used, the people who pick the food and ship it to us, the cost of transportation, all these things are moral issues that we have to adjust to in a world that is increasing in population, but not necessarily increasing in resources. In fact, diminishing in resources. Yeah. So sustainability is a new word. And I would ask people to ask themselves a simple question, which is, how can I develop a sustainable faith, and that's a double meaning, within a sustainable community that sustains God's creation for the next generation?
And we all eat, right? We all have a spiritual belief that we hold dear to our in our hearts and our souls. And so I loved hearing what you're saying, that food is a moral choice, and there's been that disconnect for so long between what you put in your mouth and what you and what you do at church. And so I really love that, Jim. How is that happening? How is that happening where you're making that connection? Have you ever been to conferences where there's been that recognition between the food you're eating potentially at a conference and the words that you're talking about?
I think so. I think it's becoming more and more prevalent. There are people who are working on the issue of food security. We recently had a UCC gathering in Florida where all our representatives from our congregations came together, and we passed a resolution about food security. It's a huge issue for people, which is access to good food near your neighborhood that's affordable, kind of thing. And so it's a real issue for poor people. So it's a natural way for us to move into this. More and more folks are talking about it. I'm not sure it's in the mainstream yet, but the people who are growing things, the people who are looking for good food, it's in their ideas too. And so as we're looking for better food, those of us who can afford it are beginning to say, can other people afford it as well? Those of us who have the affluence to shop at a place where the food costs more, we begin to say, are there other people who can do this too? And we have food deserts in many of our cities where people don't have access to good, nutritious food, and this is a moral issue.
Yeah, we just had a show on irrigating food deserts and all the actions that are being done, the programs and projects that are being put in place or have been years ago to really address that. Social poverty, right. Missing diversity. It brings up the topic of economic disparity, though.
Right.
You are saying food addresses every aspect, from farm worker health to the environment to cultural, local economic issues. One of the new seven deadly sins, as announced by the Catholic Church in 2008 and in the media widely unannounced, lists excessive wealth.
Right.
Or contributing to widening between the rich and the poor, so even creating poverty. But the topic of excessive wealth, faith-based organizations are among the most wealthiest institutions on this planet. How does that correlate with each other? What's the responsibility there, and what do you see how that's being addressed?
I think there's a long ways between pronouncing something and saying this is an ideal for us and actually putting it into action. And I think all of us have a part in that, myself included, is that in order to make the choices we need to make, we need to reexamine our lives. We need to reexamine the investments of our congregations, our churches. Are we really reaching our community in a positive way in doing this? The church is, a lot of our churches are, the people who go there are more affluent people. They have the discretionary income to do that. But a lot of our churches are full of people who do not have a lot of money, too. And so it's a wide panorama of people who go to church. I can't say one model works for all, but those of us who have more affluence, there's a problem we have. We don't want to give up what we feel like we've earned or we need or whatever, and that's a moral reexamination of what we really need or what we really want. There's a difference between those two. And we often think that what we want is what we need, when in fact what we need is far less than what we desire in our lives.
Yeah, and usually makes us much, much happier.
It does. It does. It really does. There are studies that have been done that said if there's a minimal amount of income that people, if you make that much more money, it doesn't make any happier. It really doesn't. So I think we need to get back to an idea of what really makes us happy in our communities, and things like relationships, community, neighborliness, doing things with each other, with our families. Those are values we need to get back to rather than things like what we can buy and what we can own and how much status we have in our job.
Sure.
That's part of the transformation we're talking about.
And Jim, I've noticed that during this current economic downturn, this recession that we're in, is that more and more people who I meet every day are turning to the importance of relationships and the importance of not necessarily having, but being more part of a community. And are you seeing that in many of the churches around the country as well?
I am. I think there's a movement towards what we call voluntary simplicity. And this has been going on for a long time, but more and more people are embracing this as a lifestyle, that on a reexamination, there's a time where we make this transition to that as well. And that's one of the things we talk about, is that, you know, if you have to give up everything, it feels like you're being deprived. But if you do it as a matter of faith and say, this is something I'm called to do, or I believe this is the way to live, then it lasts with you a lot longer, and there's a real great amount of satisfaction, not arrogance, but satisfaction in leading a life that's simpler.
Yeah. That's so
we're
going to
try it, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
I mean, we all have that.
As a matter of fact, it's a matter of faith.
Right.
We're almost out of time, but I do want to give you a minute to talk about or cite your most favorite part of the scriptures as it relates to environment, like where really it comes down to you, and I'm putting you on the spot. What's your favorite quote or poem or part of the Bible where you say this is really, that sums it up for me?
Well, I think in Amos 5, the prophet says that, you know, I hate all these things. God says this. I hate all these things that you give to me that you think make me happy. It says, take them away from me, the noise of your songs. I'll not listen to the melody of your harps, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Now, there's a metaphor that all of us who are involved in clean water, clean air, clean land, we can understand that. What is justice here? It's really about sharing what we have, about what is fair, what is just. I believe that's really where we need to head, is that we have a lot of work to do in our culture, and we need some guidance on that. And I believe justice is the guidance that we need.
With us, Jim Deming today, the Minister for Environmental Justice for the United Church of Christ, working with over 5,000 congregations of the United Church of Christ across the country to develop a grassroots environmental justice movement. Jim, we can't wish you more luck with everything you do, and may it be so. Wonderful work.
I appreciate you.
Yes, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Here on An Organic Conversation, I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And what a topic.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Great work.
Fantastic.
We have more lined up in this regard. We'll be speaking with an organic farmer whose very practice of organic farming for him is very, very much along the lines of what Jim Deming just spoke about. But first, here is Mark Mulcahy with What's in Season.
Well, what's in season? Well, today we are talking about something that actually might even perk up Timber's ears. We're going to be talking about the edible wolf peach. The edible wolf peach, yes. The edible wolf peach is also known as a love apple. And a love apple, for those who don't know what that is also known as something that we all love, is tomatoes, or at least a good many of us do. And this is the time of the year when the flavor is finally there. We were just having that conversation earlier before the show started about, are they there? And yes, they are. And going into this weekend, it's a perfect time to go looking for tomatoes. And even though they're called a vegetable by the Supreme Court, they are actually a fruit, yes. So you don't be confused when you hear people call them a fruit. And if you're going out and looking for them, what you want to do is you want to make sure you take a look at them and make sure they're free of blemishes and bruises. And you want to make sure that they have a deep, brightly colored flesh. But don't just go by color alone, because a lot of times tomatoes that are found in the supermarket are actually picked green, and in transit, they ripen during transit, which means they don't have as much flavor. Or they are sprayed with ethylene gas to make them turn red, which means they're not going to have that flavor that you're looking for. Another thing to look for when you're at a supermarket is to look for the word vine ripened, because if it's vine ripened, they have to at least have started with some red on the tomato before they can be shipped that way. And what I really look for when I'm picking out tomatoes is how it feels. And a good tomato needs to be firm enough to kind of resist the pressure as you put it, as you cup it in your hand, and yet not so hard that it doesn't react to your touch. You want them heavy as I say often, because the juicier the tomato is, the heavier the tomato is, the juicier it will be. It'll have a denseness of the flesh. Unripe tomatoes will actually feel light. You should try to test this out when you're in the market. And give them a whiff. Smell the tomato up by the stem. It should have a strong, sweet, earthy odor. And the more fragrant the tomato is, the more flavorful it'll be. Now, often with all the heirlooms around and all the great slicing tomatoes around, Romas get overlooked. They're kind of that tomato that during the winter you buy because it has the best flavor. But Romas are amazing grilled. They'll hold up their texture on the grill, and they have a deep, rich flavor that really comes out with grilling. Lastly for today for what's in season is if you're trying to go, okay, what's my budget? What do I want to buy? You know, organic tomatoes or non-organic tomatoes? Well, something for you to consider is that methyl bromide, which is a toxic class one pesticide used to basically kill everything in the soil, 23% of it, of the methyl bromide used in this country, is used on tomato crops. And in organic agriculture, you could never use methyl bromide. And it's also an ozone depleter. So if you're going out, go to the farmer's market, make friends with a farmer. Or if you go to the store, that would be one crop that I would definitely recommend that you buy organic. And go out there and take a nice big bite this weekend of whatever color you want. And that's what's in season.
Mark, tomatoes, wonderful. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. A wolf peach. Actually, didn't tomatoes were believed to be poisonous when they first...
when they wouldn't eat them. They were actually forbidden because they were part of the nightshade family, and they believed anything in the nightshade family would poison you.
And what changed that, or where did that come from? Because there's no peas poisonous in a tomato.
Well, they believe that because some people have reactions to tomatoes, right? And some people cannot have nightshades. They'll actually have like joint problems or things like that. So they believe that they were poisonous if they were part of the nightshade family. And then eventually people just started eating them, and that changed. I mean, just like anything.
Yes, over time we learn, don't we?
Mm-hmm. Wolf peach, Timber.
Wolf peach, Timber. Timber be my dog, for people who don't know. Who the hell is Timber?
Who the heck is Timber?
We're looking at the relationship of faith-based organizations and their role and responsibility for environmental leadership on today's An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Helbig.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
But before we dive into the next interview with Tom Willie, who with his wife Dinesse operates T.D. Willie Farms since 1988, a member of the Catholic Church and absolutely beautiful organic farmer for many years and leader in the organic movement. Here is Sita, Chef Sita, with your holistic bite.
Ah, yes, talking about tomatoes. I'm so happy that the tomatoes are finally here, and the ones that I had this week are by far the best of the season. And now that they're here, I have a million ways that I can't wait to eat them. It's like I have to cram them into fewer months because they bloom so late. But sliced and drizzled with olive oil and sea salt is always a winner. Roasted whole and stuffed with herbs and whole grains and cheeses and breadcrumbs. Or made into my most favorite pomodoro sauce, which is a recipe that I snagged from Italy. So what I'm going to share with you today, though, is a super simple recipe that is going to change your summer. It is highlighting the freshness of summer's tomatoes, and that is the panzanella salad. So panzanella salad is so genius because it makes use of day-old bread. And this time of year when you're doing so much entertaining and you're having wine and cheese and bread every evening, then you've got your leftover half a baguette that you don't know what to do with because it's stale the next day. You use it to make panzanella salad. So easy. This is what you do. Dice 2 large tomatoes and sprinkle them with about a half a teaspoon of sea salt, and that's going to draw the moisture out of the tomatoes. And then you take your day-old bread and you cube it about the same size as those tomatoes. You want about 3 cups of diced bread, but go with whatever you have. This is like leftover genius. So if you've got more or less, it'll be fine. And when you put those diced bread into the tomatoes with their juices, the bread will soak that up and soften and get really flavorful and delicious. I add about 4 tablespoons of olive oil on top of that to give some richness. And then 1 minced garlic clove, one shallot that I've sliced very, very thinly, and about 5 basil leaves. And there you go. That's panzanella salad. It is so simple. And you can make it really versatile. Use whatever you have on hand. Artichokes, black olives, capers, red bell peppers. If you have red onion, use that instead. You can use cucumber. Just get creative and enjoy something out of nothing, right? Because what are you going to do with that day-old bread other than throw it away? You're going to enjoy the best of summer, and that is tomatoes. So in addition to how delicious it is, tomatoes are so high in lycopene, which is this amazing antioxidant. And they found that when you have it with something with a healthy fat, like olive oil, the protective cancer benefits of the lycopene are magnified because lycopene is a fat-soluble nutrient. So when you have it with olive oil, it's even better for you. And organic tomatoes and products made with organic tomatoes are higher in lycopene. So there you go. That's your holistic bite. I hope you enjoy your tomatoes this weekend.
Your holistic bite with Chef Sita. Thank you, Sita. And why don't you stick around a little for the rest of the show, as we are looking at environmental stewardship and the role of faith-based organizations. But I do have a question about your holistic bite. You just said if you have your leftover baguette, you're, as me, gluten-free. Why does a baguette make it into your household?
Well,
guests only,
and for my husband. But actually, I'll make this with gluten-free bread. I'm such a sucker for millet bread, gluten-free millet bread. It's so good because millet takes on this buttery flavor when it's been toasted. So I'll just take.
So you make a good millet bread?
No, I buy a good millet bread.
I thought I almost had you
so
to
close.
Bring me one.
Well, here's the interesting thing is for our listeners, it would have been great if you could have seen Helga's face while she was describing this recipe like, but what about me?
Yes, great.
Oh, don't you worry. There's a gluten-free version out there for you.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helga Helberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we're joined by Chef Sita. And we will be speaking with Tom Willie and his wife, Dinesse, who operates a farm, an organic farm in Madera County, California, since 1981, and his understanding of ecological leadership as an organic farmer. All of that and more when we come back right after the break. Stay tuned.
There's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Produce is ever-changing, seasons coming and going. At Earls Organic, we have been sourcing solely organic produce for over 20 years. Since 1988, Earls Organic Produce has been establishing strong relationships with growers and developing a deep understanding of the seasons, so you can offer the most delicious organic produce to your customers, staff, and clients year-round. For organic produce, visit Earls Organic Produce at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Hi, my name is Abby Leeson, and I am the co-founder of The Ginger People. You can find our products in natural food stores near you. From delicious ginger drinks, sauces, spreads, ginger chews, baked goods, to skincare products. We love ginger. It's what we do. Add the benefits of ginger to your life, and you get that little kick, too. I am Abby Leeson, and I am with The Ginger People. For inspiration around ginger, go to gingerpeople.com. That's gingerpeople.com.
Thank you.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
With us still is Chef Sita. As we are looking into the role of and responsibilities of faith-based organizations, in 2008, the Catholic Church released seven new deadly sins, in this case, social sins, which includes polluting the environment, contributing to widening the divide between rich and poor, excessive wealth, and creating poverty. So we are asking this hour about the role of faith and agriculture, faith and environmental stewardship, the responsibilities of faith-based organizations and their active role and projects and programs that are being placed within the congregations. With us now on the phone, joining us from Madera, California, is Tom Willey, who, with his wife, Dinesse, is operating T.D. Willey Farms since 1981. It's a 75-acre, beautifully certified organic farm in Madera, California, growing a wide variety of Mediterranean vegetables all year round. Willey Farms is known and appreciated in specialty markets and fine restaurants up and down the West Coast, as well as on the tables of over 800 weekly community-supported agriculture CSA subscription members. Tom, welcome so much to the show.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Hey, Tom, welcome.
Good afternoon.
good afternoon. Hey, Tom, we've known each other for a lot of years, and I've always known your respect for the land, and I've seen your crops in stores all around the country with that familiar T&D Willey sticker that you put on them. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your land and what you grow?
Well, we steward 75 acres here in Madera, California, which is in the central San Joaquin Valley, relatively near to Fresno, although we broke away from them some time ago, so we don't like to associate ourselves with Fresno that much. But we're farming 75 acres in Madera, and on that 75 acres, we grow nearly 50 different vegetable crops on a seasonal year-round basis.
And so right now, what are some of the things that you would have?
That we're harvesting right now, we're harvesting obviously warm season things, tomatoes, peppers, basil, eggplant, squash, okra, things of that nature.
Oh, fantastic.
We're establishing all the crops for the fall.
Now, Tom, you said you were stewarding the land. How is your faith connected with your ideas and daily practices in farming and land stewardship?
Well, I guess that is kind of a biblical reference.
Mm-hmm.
And, we're enjoined with the stewardship of the land in the Bible, actually in Genesis. I think the most direct connection that you could tell us, that Genesis tells us, is that we are from and of the soil, and unto the soil we shall return. That's a relatively direct quote from Genesis. I think my Catholic faith in particular connects me spiritually to the soil, because the most important ritual or sacrament that we practice frequently is the Eucharist, and the Eucharist is actually changing the products of the soil, grapes and wheat or bread and wine, into the body and blood of Christ or God. So that's kind of profound. So when I'm out there kicking clods, I'm it's a pretty direct connection to my concept of God, or the being that powers the entire universe.
Tom, did you become a farmer because of your faith, or did that happen? Have you been always since childhood member of the Catholic Church? Which came first, or when did the connection? When was the connection made?
I became a farmer because I eat food, and that even though we probably spent a great deal more of our human history as hunter-gatherers. Here's another connection. When we were kicked out of the Garden of Eden, that's also in Genesis, we were told that we were no longer going to get a free pass of just picking the low-hanging fruit of the beneficent nature, but we had to go out there and scratch the earth and make our own way because of our sinfulness. Mm-hmm. And so since then, we have been agriculturalists, and we've had to work hard for what we eat every day. And so I guess my becoming a farmer, of which all of us, really just a few generations ago, the majority of all people in society were farmers, and now, at least in our culture, very few of us are, maybe less than 2% actually practice it, but our, you know, our biological and our spiritual natures, all of us are farmers. And so I guess I just came to that kind of realization, and I wanted to work with what I thought was the essence of life and the essence of my role on the planet, and that's to feed myself and to feed my neighbors as a commercial farmer. And so I got back to my roots, and that's in the soil.
Mm-hmm. And you've been doing this since 1981 at your current farm. Tom, why do you think that there is such a modern-day disconnect between agriculture and the care of the land and any of us, as well as people of faith?
Well, I think because we have turned our production of food into an industrial process, and we've made each farmer, because of his ability to use machinery and chemistry, into, you know, being able to produce for hundreds of others. And so most of us have become disconnected in our professions or our workday from the production of our own food. And as a result, we've become somewhat forgetful of the importance of that connection. You know, in the early days of the United States, around 1800, the early days of our nation, you know, everyone practically was a farmer, including people like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and they used to argue, you know, farming issues very, very vehemently and vocally in the Congress, in the halls of Congress in those early days. And so everybody was then involved in agricultural production, and everybody had a great deal of sympathy for the hard work that's done on the soil. But that's not so much true now that we've industrialized that process. And there's some good from, you know, as a result of that, and some bad. And one of the bad things about it is that we've lost, or many of us have kind of lost that spiritual connectedness to the soil. But that's what we certainly like about doing our CSA, is that we're trying to bring at least those customers more intimately connected with our farm and the soil of our farm. And that's a great part of that movement.
Our previous guest, Jim Deming, the Minister for Environmental Justice for the United Church of Christ, early in the show said that food is a moral choice. And what I'm hearing you saying is agriculture is an act of, or a task of faith. How do you communicate your spiritual beliefs to your customers? Are you actively connecting those two?
Yes, we certainly our CSA customers are the 800 customers that eat directly from our farm every week. They receive their fruits and vegetables with a newsletter from our farm, and so I kind of proselytize to my captive audience.
That's your congregation, of course.
Yes, my congregation.
What's the feedback you're getting?
Mark knows well, we also used to put a lot of spiritual and other
quotes,
messages about
yes.
agriculture in our philosophy of the land in our wholesale produce boxes, too.
And how is that received, Tom? Are people open to it, or even more so, do they embrace it, or do they accept it? Do people choose you because your customers make that connection, and it's important that that is being upheld, both the faith as well as the connection to the environment?
I think that's part of it. I mean, we're not overtly religious in the way we peddle our produce, but you know, the beliefs and the tenets of our faith that relate to our work on the land, we certainly express those to people.
Wonderful. With us is Tom Willey, who with his wife Dinesse operates T.D. Willey Farm since 1981. And we want to finish with a shout out for your radio program. You're a radio host yourself. Do you want to?
Yes, I'm a competitor of you fellows.
Yes, use our time to promote your show right now. Where can people listen to your program, Tom?
Well, if you're out of the central San Joaquin Valley listening audience, then you can hear it live streaming on kfcf.org or www.kfcf.org. And it runs only on the first Friday of the month from 5 to 6 p.m.
And what is it called?
Pardon me?
It's called what?
It's called Down on the Farm.
Down on the Farm with Tom Willie. Wonderful. I hope people are listening in, and I hope people listen to both shows and don't just convert over to your. But
well, they can listen to your show more frequently.
Yes, Tom Willie of TD Willie Farms. Thank you, Tom, for joining us today. Wonderful to have you. A pleasure.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks Tom. Care. Appreciate it.
We explored the relationship between church and faith-based organizations and their responsibility and programs and awareness around environmental stewardship today on An Organic Conversation.
Yeah, fantastic. It was such a pleasure having Tom and Jim on today, and that just that whole connection to the land and to...
You don't hear much about it in the news, ever. Now you do. Now you do.
Yes, now you do. Or yes. Maybe on the Down on the Farm show or something like that. But I tell you what, Ed, what a beautiful, beautiful show.
And now is the time to listen to you, our listeners, as we're opening up our weekly mailbag.
Yeah, well, we did have a great mailbag from a great email from Ryan, and he was saying that he lives outside of Canby, Minnesota, and his in-laws had a garden, an organic garden, and were going to make a nursery out of it when a neighbor hired the local farmers co-op to spray the land next to them with 2,4-D herbicide and ended up spraying the property. And needless to say, the garden was completely destroyed and they could no longer eat any of the produce. And he was asking Helga and I, he was wondering if we could help point him in a direction to help figure out what his legal rights are. Well, there was a case in California where Jacobs Farm won a lawsuit that will force pesticide application companies to be responsible for the drift of their pesticides. And so you might want to look into that, Ryan. Go to Jacobs Farm. .com, and you can look up, and they'll tell you about the lawsuit there. And I think that's the best place to start because Larry fought hard for that one.
And we love your comments and questions and cases, and send everything you feel like sending to share@anorganicconversation.com, and you might get picked to be part of the mailbag every week.
But before we leave today, I want to make sure that we get to, as I always say, one of my favorite things. I think it's such a great way to end the show, and that is Helga's organic moment. Helga, you got something for us today?
Yeah, we had a news piece in the beginning of the show about the Food and Freedom Riders, a group of 13 youth traveling across the country with a van this summer to expose and uplift stories from farmers, food chain workers, Indian reservations, community garden supporters, and working to combat food deserts and health issues related to obesity. The group commemorates the freedom rides of the civil rights era with their journey, in this case, exposing food injustices in communities across America. When I first heard about it last week, I was quick to wonder what impact this tour might have, if any, how many people they will really reach, and if it will even make a difference in the food movement on a large scale. And then I saw a quote in a furniture catalog of all places, by Teddy Roosevelt, and I was reminded that criticism is not the place I want to live in. The quote is from Roosevelt's famous speech at the Sorbonne in Paris from 1910. He said, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles. The credit belongs to the man in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who at his worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat." So to the Food and Freedom Riders, I say, your tour is awesome, and I hope you have an amazing time learning and teaching as you just taught me. And may you reach the right hearts and minds to help grow the awareness around the issues and opportunities of food production in this country and far, far beyond. I'm inspired by your efforts, so please keep writing. And may we all live a life in action.
Yes, success is not defined by victory or defeat. It's defined by action. Very good.
Yes, keep writing.
Yeah, and that was this week's edition of An Organic Conversation. Thanks for listening.
An Organic Conversation is a production of the Organic Media Network. Associate producer is Vanessa Farron. If you missed parts of this show or for any other show, go to iTunes or anorganicconversation.com. We are your hosts, Helge Hellberg
and Mark Mulcahy.
And we look forward to seeing you next week. We'll be back right here, same place, same time. See you then.
Bye-bye now.